From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, advancing the cause of peace in Ireland, we talk with John Hume, founder and president of the Social Democratic and Labour Party in Northern Ireland and a longtime advocate of nonviolence. Hume played an important role in establishing the ceasefire agreement in Northern Ireland, an agreement that was broken by the recent IRA bombings in London. Also, journalist Scott Minerbrook grew up in a family divided. His father was black and his mother was white, and her family was intolerant of the marriage. We'll talk with Minerbrook about his new memoir. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Criminals, the new thriller by Scottish writer Margot Livesey. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, sitting in for Terry Gross. Two bomb blasts in London last month signaled the end of the 17-month ceasefire, which had brought peace to Northern Ireland and halted terrorist attacks in England. The IRA claimed responsibility for the bombings, which killed three people and injured many more. The resumption of violence threatens future prospects for peace negotiations, but talks are scheduled to resume in June. My guest, John Hume, was instrumental in forging the ceasefire and setting the peace process in motion. He met secretly with Gerry Adams, the head of the IRA's political wing, Sinn Féin, to establish negotiations between the London and Dublin governments and parties in Northern Ireland. John Hume has been a voice for nonviolence in Northern Ireland, where 25 years of political warfare have left 3,000 dead and more than 30,000 wounded or disabled. He is a founder and leader of the Social Democratic and Labour Party of Northern Ireland, which has worked for the unification of Ireland. John Hume has written a book about his efforts to bring about a reconciliation called A New Ireland. I asked him about the recent bombings in London.
Well, of course, it was very, very regrettable, and the London bomb was an awful atrocity. And the 17 months of peace really transformed the atmosphere on our streets, and the mood among the people for peace was very, very powerful. It was very heavily underlined by the visit of President Clinton because it gave the people the opportunity to speak with their feet. They come out in their thousands to welcome him and express their massive support for peace and their massive gratitude to President Clinton for the role he had played. And that mood is still there very powerfully, and that's what gives me hope, that the mood for peace is so strong, because given that for the first time in their life, young people under 30 had experienced what peace really meant, and that has created an enormous mood, and I think no one can ignore that, and I'm hopeful that we can restore the peace process. I think that when the peace process started, I engaged in dialogue with Gerry Adams, the leader of the Sinn Féin. And we stated two objectives in our dialogue. One was a total cessation of violence, followed by all-party talks, whose objective would be agreement among our divided people. And the agreement would have to have the allegiance of all traditions. In other words, a process that threatened no one. Unfortunately, we achieved the first stage, which was a total cessation of violence. But 17 months later, for different reasons, we hadn't moved on to the next stage, which was all-party talks. And I think that the delay in moving to all-party talks was one of the reasons that we are in the situation we're in today. But I certainly hope that we will restore the peace on our streets.
Have you spoken with Gerry Adams since the bomb blast in London?
Oh, yes, I have spoken. I maintain regular contact with him. And we're both working very hard to restore the peace process. In fact, we both met with the IRA to persuade them to restore the peace process, and I hope that we will be successful.
In meeting with the IRA, what was their explanation for the bomb blasts?
Well, they explained in their statements that, in their view, they thought that the peace process wasn't moving forward. My meeting with them was to persuade them to stop again, and they said in a statement afterwards, of course, that they are willing to embrace a negotiated settlement. In other words, I believe that if we can get a firm commitment to all-party talks whose objective is a comprehensive negotiated agreement among our divided people, I believe that we can restore the peace process. I welcome very much the fact that both governments have now committed themselves to a very firm date for all-party talks, and I hope that we can achieve the situation where all parties will be at those talks without preconditions.
Who and what do you hold responsible for the delays in the negotiations? As you said, the ceasefire had been in effect for 17 months, but negotiations hadn't really gone forward. Why not?
Well, I think that one of the reasons was that once the peace broke out, once we had a total cessation of violence, then the British government produced a precondition that there should be decommissioning of arms before talks took place. In other words, that there should be a handing over of arms by the IRA, which in Irish terms amounts to a surrender. And of course, anyone who knows the Irish knows that there's a very powerful no-surrender mentality. And that's not something that has ever happened anywhere else where there's been conflict. And that delayed matters quite substantially. And then, of course, Senator George Mitchell's commission was appointed to resolve the situation and, in my opinion, produced a very sensible report. But unfortunately, that report was not, although it was praised very warmly by everyone and by the British government in particular, it wasn't implemented. And instead of that, they announced the possibility of further elections, etc. And I think it was at that stage that the IRA, unfortunately and tragically, decided to resume their campaign. In my belief, had the Mitchell report been implemented, we would still have peace in our streets.
Do you think it is possible to negotiate when various factions are armed?
If we're going to have lasting stability and lasting peace, we have to have agreement on our system of government. And the only way of achieving that is by bringing all parties to the table. All parties to the table. That should be the urgent priority of everyone, particularly of governments. And tragically in Ireland, the gun has been part of our history on both sides of our divide. And as I keep saying over there, quoting Martin Luther King, the old doctrine of an eye for an eye leaves everybody blind. We've got to get the gun out of our politics. And my view is that given the 20,000 soldiers haven't stopped it, and 12,000 armed policemen haven't stopped it, and the strictest security laws in Europe haven't stopped it, that if I could stop it by dialogue, it was my duty to do so by dialogue. And I believe that dialogue brought us 18 months of peace, and it's dialogue that will bring us lasting peace and stability. And it's for that reason I want all parties, including those that represent the armed groups, at the table.
Because this conflict has been so personal, because everybody has been touched in one way or another by the violence, does that make it easier or harder to try to find a negotiated settlement? On the one hand, I would think that for some, the need for revenge is very powerful.
My greatest encouragement came in the many letters I received from people who had lost their loved ones. And they were mostly saying the same thing to me. Keep talking, because if by talking you can save human life, you will be preventing people from suffering from what we've had to suffer. And they wrote to me telling me that they were wishing me well and praying for me. And one of the most moving occasions I had, when I attended a funeral of six people killed, murdered in a bar by loyalist paramilitaries in my district. And as I was at the funeral, a young girl came up to me and said to me, "We were praying for you around my daddy's coffin last night. We were praying that you would be successful in your talks to get peace, because we don't want what happened to us to happen to anyone else." That was real Christianity. And when you consider the situation in Northern Ireland, where you have the highest church-going population in Western Europe in the city of Belfast, it's been necessary to build 13 walls to separate and protect one section of that people from another. Then the powerful message of that young girl is a real message of peace. Revenge is not a solution. Revenge only carries on the problem. And those walls are a challenge to all of us, because what they scream at us is that our past attitudes have built them. and therefore, if we are to resolve the problem, each side has to re-examine its past attitude.
John Hume is my guest, and he's the founder and leader of the Social Democratic and Labour Party of Northern Ireland, a member of the British House of Commons, and the author of a new book called A New Ireland. What is your vision and the vision of the other nationalists within Northern Ireland for its future?
Well, of course, we recognise that we are a divided people, and therefore that any solution must respect the diversity of our people. And for that reason, we have to create institutions in Ireland, within the North and between North and South, which respect our differences. And in doing that, I think we will be considerably assisted by the fact that we are now living in the new Europe, where 50 years ago, the peoples of Europe, 135 million people lay dead 50 years ago, right across Europe. Who could have forecast then that in 50 years' time there would be a united Europe? And the Germans are still German and the French are still French, yet it has happened. And how did they do it? They did it by recognising that difference is not a threat. That difference is natural. There's not two human beings in the entire human race who are the same. It's an accident of birth, what you're born and where you're born. And that accident of birth, whether of colour, nationality or religion, should never be the source of hatred or conflict. The answer to difference is to respect it, not to fight about it. And to build institutions, which is what they did in Europe, institutions which respected their differences but allowed them to work together in the common interest, which is economics, bread on your table and a roof over your head.
You favour the unification of Northern Ireland with the Irish Republic.
Well, like many Irish people, I would like to see the unity of Ireland, but recognising that the real border in Ireland is not a line in a map, it's in the minds and hearts of people. I recognise that you can't remove a border in the minds of hearts in the minds and hearts of people in a week or a fortnight. What we need to do is create the institutions that allow our people to work together. And as I was just saying, if we follow the European example and set up institutions within Northern Ireland that respect the differences and involve both sections of our community and institutions between North and South, which allow us to work together in our common interest, that by working then together through those institutions in our common interest, spilling our sweat and not our blood, our common interest being economics and building the country, and of course in that we would get massive assistance from the Irish in America. And that will then evolve into a new Ireland in a generation or two, whose model of which will probably be very different from the traditional models of the past, but it will be built by agreement and by respect for diversity.
Let me get you to be specific, if I can. What would be an example of an institution you think that would gather people together of common interests and create, or I guess as you see it, would erase the kind of mental border between North and South?
Well, take my own city, the city of Derry, where the Troubles started, and which was the worst example of injustice in the old Northern Ireland, because the Unionists were 30% of the population, yet they governed the city by a system of gerrymander and discrimination in housing and jobs and voting rights. Now, my party, the Social Democratic and Labour Party, are in charge of the city. We have a major majority. But what we do instead of what we do in running the city is we change the mayor each year. We could have the mayor every year, but what we do, we take it 1 year, Unionist the next year, Catholic, Protestant. We change the mayor every year. The chairs of the committees in the city council, we give one to each party. We could take all this, but we don't. And what that does is creates a team spirit. We respect our differences at the political level and we work together for the city. And of course, in the last 12 months, we've had 2,500 jobs from American investment into our city, which is, our city is now the European headquarters of DuPont, of Fruit of the Loom, of Seagate International, and Stream International recently announced that they're coming in. So we've, by working together, as I say, spilling our sweat and not our blood. In other words, by creating institutions which respect our differences and give a role to each section of our community, that's really what we're talking about.
I'm speaking with John Hume, the founder and leader of the Social Democratic and Labour Party of Northern Ireland. He's a member of the British House of Commons and the author of a new book called A New Ireland. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. John Hume is my guest, and he's the founder, leader of the Social Democratic and Labour Party of Northern Ireland, and his new book is called A New Ireland. You were born in 1937. You grew up in Derry, the oldest of seven children. What kind of a neighbourhood did you grow up in?
Well, I grew up in what would have been a mixed neighbourhood in Derry terms, you know, both sections of the community. But it was very working class, a lot of unemployed people. My father was unemployed. That was, you know, in those days, the unemployment was very, very massive. And, of course, in the Catholic community, a lot of it was a result of serious discrimination against us.
Well, your father lost his job when you were 8 years old. This was after World War II. He never worked again.
That's correct. He was a very, very, in my opinion, a very brilliant man. He hadn't been educated because in his day, if you came from working class or poor backgrounds, you didn't get educated if your family didn't have the money to pay for you. I was lucky in that I was 10 years old in the first year of a new system of examinations in Northern Ireland of public education, which if you passed the examinations, you got scholarships. It paid for your education at secondary level. And I was very lucky to have passed that and got my scholarship and got scholarships right through to university without it costing my parents anything. And, of course, I believe that that transformation in education, while nothing had happened to deal with the discrimination against our population politically over the years, I think the biggest thing that happened to change the situation was public education, because it produced a whole new generation of educated people from the minority community in Northern Ireland. And they applied their minds to creating justice and equality for all sections of the people.
Your father then, after you turned eight, he never had a job again. Would he go down every day to look for work, and he was denied work?
Oh, yes. I mean, but, you know, in addition to the fact that work didn't exist, it was part of the policy of the unionists running the city at that time not to bring work into the city, because they were 30% of the population, and in order to control the city they were encouraging immigration because they didn't want more jobs and more work made it more difficult for their gerrymandered electoral system to work.
Was your father bitter?
No, he was never a bitter man.
Why not?
I don't know why not, but he never was bitter, and he did a lot of work for other people, because he was a very bright and highly intelligent man. And when I was a child, my earliest memories are sitting at a table doing my homework, and at the other side of the table, my father talking to people who come in for him to write letters for them because of their problems of unemployment and housing and health, etc.
And he could write.
And he wrote for them, yes.
And your mother, as I understand it, could only write her name.
That's right. In those days, you see, the women of Derry built the city, because the only real work in the city were the shirt factories. The first shirt factory in the world opened in Derry in 1842. And it's still a major centre of the shirt industry in the world. And the women of Derry worked in that. And we had a situation when I was growing up, when the women did the work, a lot of the work, and the men were unemployed. And my mother, I remember, she, while rearing our family, couldn't go out to work during the day, but she worked at night at home doing outwork for the shirt factories. And, of course, that was very common in those days. and a young woman, rather than go to school in their early days, went and learned how to make shirts so that they could get themselves work in the shirt factories.
When would you say you became politically active?
Well, it depends what you call politics. Yeah. When I came back from university, I was 23 years old, and I felt that since I was one of the lucky ones, having passed exams, the problems of poverty and unemployment were still very strong in the community and in my own streets. I felt I had a duty to do everything I could. So I got involved in community development, which wasn't party politics. I got involved in the foundation of the credit union movement. I got involved in the foundation of the housing association, whereby we set up our own self-help housing body to build houses for our people because the politicians wouldn't give them housing. And how I got into politics was when they wouldn't give us planning permission to build houses because it would have upset the voting balance in the gerrymandered districts. Then I went to the streets in the civil rights movement. And of course, that was in the 60s. And the civil rights movement in Northern Ireland was very heavily inspired by people like Martin Luther King. And I was one of the leaders of the civil rights movement, and that led me directly into politics.
You write in your book that the strife between Irish and English races can be traced back to the 12th century, and you say that Northern Ireland today represents unfinished business in ancient conflicts between two islands. That seems like an enormous undertaking to try to put 800 years of history at rest, 800 years of violence and certainly suspicion, repression, and suffering. What makes you optimistic?
Well, of course, what makes me optimistic is that the world we're living in today is a very different world than the world of the past. We're living in a new Europe. For Britain came into Ireland in the first place because of Ireland's links with Spain and France. She wanted to close the back door to what were then her European enemies. And, of course, the Northern Ireland problem is not a Northern Ireland problem. It's a British-Irish problem. The failure of Britain and Ireland to sort out their quarrel of sovereignty was pushed into a corner and called Northern Ireland, and sat there for 50 years until it erupted. But now Britain and Ireland are together in the new Europe, together with the Germans, the French, the Spanish. We're now living in a post-nationalist world. We're moving beyond the nation state. And, of course, that should make it easier for us to Britain and Ireland work together in common at European level, together with the French and the Spanish, so that, as I say, that new world and new atmosphere should make it easier for us to settle that ancient quarrel.
John Hume, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
John Hume is president of the Social Democratic and Labour Party in Northern Ireland. His book is entitled A New Ireland. I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Divided to the Vein, we talk with journalist Scott Minerbrook about exploring his own family's racism. His father was black and his mother was white. Minerbrook is a national correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. And Maureen Cargan reviews the new thriller Criminals by Scottish writer Margot Livesey. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, in for Terry Gross. For Scott Minerbrook, the problem of race relations has been played out in his own family. His father is black, his mother is white. While his father's family reluctantly accepted his mother, her side of the family completely ostracized the couple and their children. In 1990, Scott Minerbrook decided to go to Missouri to find out who the white half of his family was. He's written a book about his experiences trying to reclaim his family and about growing up in the 50s and 60s called Divided to the Vein. Minerbrook was interested in particular in reconciling with his mother's mother because, as he writes, I couldn't love myself if I hated my own flesh and blood. Let's begin with Scott Minerbrook reading from the beginning of his memoir.
Mine is the intermingled blood of African ancestors, of Scots-Irish farmers who mixed their blood with the blood of Cherokee survivors of the Trail of Tears dispersal, of Choctaw who mixed their blood with the blood of slaves and traveled north to Chicago. These lives form the divided root of my childhood. Their notions of race and family course through the veins of my expectations, hopes, and dreams. My race and my family were always at odds. Osceola, whom I was now traveling to see, was my mother's mother, but my grandmother in name only. I had never claimed Osceola, and she had never claimed me. Osceola was part of my family, but not of my race. My father is black, my mother is white, and the meaning of the two words, family, fell into the rushing waters between the two. Blood was not thicker than these racialized waters. I grew up well aware that if all my relatives were brought together in one room, there would be a race riot. Somebody would call someone else a name, and there would be blood on the walls. The violence of race hate has shaped the divided ground of my soul. Too dark to be white, too light to be black. I've always known that my family's racial quarrels have not done me little good.
What I think is very clear reading through your book is that race is not an intellectual idea. It certainly isn't in your family because it's about blood. Mm-hmm. But thinking of again of the larger society, I think it isn't an intellectual idea. It has to do with blood and veins and bones and appearance and skin.
Oh, it has to do with your soul. It has to do with who accepts you and who doesn't. It has to do with the question of how do you frame the ideas of outsiders and insiders? How do you frame the idea and define the word enemy? And how do you go about trying to understand your enemy? And are they truly enemies? Mm-hmm. And it has to do with the question of family itself. I mean, we've all been raised to think that family is the most important unit, and I didn't, because I felt that my mother came from people who were totally intolerant. And, you know, these were the crackers, you know, who would shoot after my father's family. I used to have fantasies when I was a boy that my mother's father, whose name was Clarence, would go to a lynching and probably enjoy it. I mean, these are the kinds of thoughts that I grew up with as a child.
Why at the age of 40, and this was about 1990, you wanted to go and search out this white grandmother, mm-hmm. Osceola, down in Missouri. Mm-hmm. Why then, do you think, did you want to try to seek her out and to seek out this white family that had been denied to you?
Well, it was just as simple as really deciding that I didn't want to be a hating person, that I didn't want to really be a bitter person. I didn't want to have this kind of racial bitterness in front of me all the time. I wanted to really challenge it and explore it. I wanted to find out, were they truly my enemies or was this in me? And I went down there. I'd always wanted to go, but I was afraid to, because my mother had always told me stories about how dangerous it was mm-hmm. to black people, and of course she was absolutely right. But I'd wanted to challenge my own experience here and to try to redefine myself. I mean, it seems to me that being an American requires that you redefine yourself and that you reinvent yourself.
How did your parents meet?
Oh, they met in Chicago. They were both students. My mother had come from from Missouri and moved to St. Louis, and then from St. Louis went to Chicago, where she was in business for herself. She had a couturier shop. She was, a designer, essentially, mm-hmm. in business for herself, and was really trying to improve herself. Went to Roosevelt University, and my father was a World War II veteran who had come back, you know, and survived, in a sense, the Chicago streets, and was from a well-to-do family. One of the inversions that happened for me because of race was that I always felt that my mother's family were the inferior ones, because how could anybody claim to be superior and reject out of hand somebody simply because of the color of their skin? I mean, it's just the worst. Whereas my father's family, which accepted me, which was a black family, I've always been tremendously impressed with them. My father had gone to West Point Military Academy when I was a kid. I opened up the closet and saw this beautiful tunic and this uniform, and I have two PhD recipients in my family, just very, very brilliant people. And so my whole racial values were turned on their ear. And I really, the way that they met, I mean, you know, was in struggle. Their relationship was born in struggle. One of their early dates, they were both beaten in Chicago, and so this was really a lifetime physical struggle for them. They had a lot of work to do.
Well, and of course, there were laws against interracial marriages.
That's
and,
right.
And in a sense, against
up until 1967.
That's right. Fact. I mean, you were born in 1951. The product of an interracial marriage.
That's right. In many states in the United States, I would have been illegal.
Right.
And I've met a lot of
people.
What
does that mean? What would that mean to be illegal?
I would be a bastard. I would be born out of wedlock. They would not honor the institution of marriage. So essentially, my birth, in addition to being bastardy and in addition to being, not condoned in the eyes of law, I would exist as a non-person. I mean, America is full of apartheid, and this is really the deep history of the United States, sort of the unacknowledged history of the United States, is the idea that these codes, in the slave codes and the early actual laws in Virginia and Maryland and the early colonies, that there were legislators, landowners, who decided, well, we're going to have to decide whether or not the produce or the children of black unions and white unions are going to be slaves. Will they be slaves? And of course, many of the early laws said that they would, that even the children would be slaves up until the age of 31 or 27. It depended by state by state. But then, of course, these laws were changed so that in many cases you were a slave for life, just like your parents. So I mean, this race doesn't come from a vacuum. It comes from legal tradition, and it has to do with the idea of ownership.
You talk about your father's family accepting you and making you part of it. Yet you also write that when your father fell in love with your mother, they, quote, thought that this ignorant white girl was out to get their beautiful boy killed.
That's right, yes.
And that this was, I mean, it's true, this was a dangerous relationship back
yes,
in those
was.
Times.
Yes, it was.
But not something they were entirely comfortable with.
Not at all. And I think that they were, in some measure, justified. I mean, it meant not only that he would be killed physically or that he was put in a very dangerous position physically and would always have to defend himself.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to defend himself mentally against, prejudice by employers, for instance, and physically, but also in the sense of that they might lose him across the color line. In other words, that the privileges that he would enjoy as, in theory, this is what they believed, if he left the black community, would only further isolate him from them, that they would lose him. And that was based on historical knowledge. I mean, the whole experience of race is quite different, profoundly different for blacks as it is for whites. Mm-hmm. Blacks have always accepted whites, but only to a point into the black community, and they've always accepted the children of interracial marriage, but to a point. And the standard in the black community is that you sort of agree to the idea that if you have one drop of black blood, that you acknowledge this racist idea in America, that's ensconced in American law, you are black. But I think that there were all kinds of things that they saw about the marriage that my mother could not see because she was a white woman and she didn't really understand. So the first conversation that my grandmother, my father's mother, Catherine, had with my mother was in Chicago, and she and Catherine asked, first question that she asked my mother was, what race will your children be?
Yeah.
Now, this
yeah.
was not a really nice question. I mean, it was a really very straightforward, a knife of a question. And my mother blew it. She said, well, we'll let them decide. She didn't understand that, for the children of interracial families, a decision, a choice has to be made. And it usually means that the white person in the family has to give up some of their privilege and has to begin to see that there are other possibilities that are open to their child that they were not open to. And this is a tremendously important thing for interracial couples. And I think that my mother didn't understand it. Huh. And my father didn't understand it fully either. I think that they were both always on the pioneer fringe, on the pioneer edge. And really, the book is about pioneers. It's about the pioneer experience. I see my parents as pioneers.
Well, you see them as idealistic, but as you describe it, this was a violent marriage. Your father had problems with drugs and alcohol.
Yes.
He beat his wife.
Yes.
He beat you. He was a threatening and in many ways a dangerous person to live with.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there's any... Can you say that's because of the race problems in this country? Mm-hmm. Does that in part describe the difficulty they had in being a married couple?
Well... Yes, and it also describes the difficulty that my father has had and I've had of being a human being. I mean, the most difficult thing that I've had to try to do in the book is to try to pull apart the question of race when it comes to the physical quarrels that they had.
Yeah.
You know, how much of this was because they used race to... as a way of not exploring sort of some of the deeper conflicts that they both brought to the marriage.
You say they both used race to avoid deeper personal problems.
Well, yes, and deeper personal challenges. I mean, as an adult, it's not easy to grow. You know, adulthood's not for sissies, and you really constantly have to confront yourself. So, you know, this is where race becomes extremely complex. And my father... you know, had been exposed to drugs as a boy in Chicago as a result of, you know, some of the things that were happening after the Second World War. He'd become addicted to heroin. You know, he was the son of the black elite. And so what's been interesting for me is to sort of see how this happens for people in the black middle class. And this is sort of the things, the taboo, unmentionable things in the black community. I mean, you know, you write about this stuff and the first thing that you run into as well, but you, black men don't talk about their fathers in public. Black men do not talk about their mothers in public.
Why not?
It's simply taboo. You simply don't do it. It is not done. I mean, the shame of oppression is such in America that, you know, you're supposed to defend your parents. In fact, there's a thing in the black community we call the dozens where, you know, immediately you go to, you know, the jugular and sort of joke around with, sort of flirting with a lot of danger, verbal play and sort of, well, you know, you're never really supposed to get to that point where you say, well, you're mama. And there are real cultural values in the black community where you don't talk about your parents.
Well, you talk in quite great detail about your parents. Have you broken this taboo? Did you want to break this taboo with your book?
Yeah, I did.
To say this is who they were, and it's in many ways not a pretty picture.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some moments of reconciliation, but it's scary.
Yeah, well, I had a pretty interesting childhood. I mean, my parents were both very, very driven people, very, very successful professionally. We lived in Connecticut. My father moved us from New York, from Chicago, then to New York, then to Connecticut. He was living the dream, you know, and he was living the dream, I came to realize later, for his whole family. In other words, this is sort of what the aspiration of being black and middle class was, to go to Connecticut, to go to Massachusetts, to go someplace where supposedly that the racial barriers were not so visible and not so obvious. And then to go to a place like that and find that the barriers are very much there. We were blockbusters. I mean, we moved into this little leafy Connecticut neighborhood.
Norwalk, Connecticut.
In Norwalk. Yeah. And as wonderful as the experience was for me, it was brutally harsh for my father. I mean, he was very isolated from his family, very lonesome. He had a very complicated relationship with his own mother, who was a very powerful black woman from a powerful family of black women. And, you know, so all the psychological scars that come about from that alone was enough, I think, to make him a little unstable. And I think that when he drank, unfortunately, you know, he just wasn't any good when he drank. I mean, not many people are. So I try to deal with some of these emotional legacies and say, well, what's race in that? And, you know, race at that point, to some extent, becomes kind of a self-limiting or a self-imposed exile. And I think that at that point, that's where their marriage began to really conflict, and was that the things that brought them together also blew them apart, that they couldn't really confront, that they saw themselves as an interracial couple almost first and didn't realize, but that doesn't mean, at some point, it doesn't mean anything at all.
Scott Minerbrook's memoir is Divided to the Vein. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Let's get back to writer Scott Minerbrook. His book is called Divided to the Vein. From past interviews that I've done with people who come from biracial parents, many of them talk about feeling as if they are spies, they identify themselves one way, but the world doesn't necessarily identify themselves one way. And many can live and work in the white world, and everyone think that they're white, mm-hmm. and yet they think of themselves as black, and feel in a sense as if they are a spy, as if mm-hmm. they hear things mm-hmm. that someone who is identified as black wouldn't hear. Do you feel that?
Oh, sure. That's a great point. I mean, it's... this is part of the American experience also. I mean, but it works both ways. I mean, one of the things that I learned when I was in Caruthersville was that blacks...
And this is Missouri, too.
Caruthersville in southeast Missouri, where my mother grew up,
right.
Was that, you know, in this experience of sharecropping, where blacks and whites were you know, equally impoverished, blacks were subjected, of course, to certain kinds of laws that whites did not, but were not subjected to. But in many cases... When there was, a lynch mob, or when there was community punishment that was going to be doled out to the blacks, many times it was poor whites who would warn the poor blacks that this was going to happen as it was going on, as it was being, so that they had, that poor whites in many ways helped blacks to survive.
Hmm.
And these are things that we have to really look at very, very closely, I think, in our American history, that you know, there are all kinds of fascinating attempts at interracial community in this country that we don't look at. Guthrie, Oklahoma, we don't look at these things. But there's an ongoing attempt in this country to combine many, many different ideas of culture. And those, unfortunately, have not become the dominant ways of looking at. So race is really about how you see the future, too. It's mm-hmm. about whether or not you cling to an idea that really is very partialized. In other words, that the only history of the United States is the history of rich white people. That's nonsense.
Scott, I actually wanted to have you read from the end of your book, and the book begins with you going down to try to find this white grandmother who had rejected the family, and
right.
now, like 250 pages later, you do find her.
Yes.
And she's in a nursing home.
Right. Well, this was my second trip. The first trip I'd made, and she'd refused to see me, and I had to think this over for about a year and try to figure it out, and I figured out that she was just as much of a prisoner as I was, and that her prison was her fear, and that my prison had been my fear, but that maybe her example had helped me to overcome my fear. So I went back, and it was very interesting. The black people in Caruthersville, who were well connected in the nursing home, helped sneak me in to get past the gatekeepers and arrange this meeting. If it weren't for the blacks in Caruthersville, I would never have met her. That's the first thing. But when I did meet her, something happened to me, and I'll try to describe it in this passage. I stood over Osceola and looked at her hands. They were exactly like my mother's, small but strong, with stocky peasant's fingers. My mother had supported a family with those hands, and Osceola had fed her family by chopping cotton with hers. I had always been amazed that my mother could produce such wonderful artwork and clothing designs with hands as unshapely, almost blunt, as hers. Even my mother had called them unsightly, but now they seemed beautiful. As I looked at Osceola, I was amazed to see that my mother had also inherited her small nose. I realized then that this was probably what my mother would look like in her late years, and I felt that in some way I'd been given the gift of seeing into the future by looking at my past. In 20 years, maybe I would look something like this myself, though I nourished the hope that my African and Native American blood would weigh more heavily in my favor.
Hmm. What did it mean to finally see this grandmother? I mean, she's prickly. There's no question about it, prickly to the end. But mm-hmm. but you were able to have a kind of reconciliation in the nursing home. What did that mean for you?
Well, it was interesting to me that she kept saying that she wanted me to be the messenger. I mean, that she saw my role as being a messenger to her daughter and to tell her daughter, my mother, that she loved her.
Right.
And so that was what my role was. And that, I'd hoped for sort of a more direct recognition of myself. But I had to say that, you know, but that's not the way God intended it, or fate, or, you know, the Furies, or whatever intended it. And it turned out that she insisted that my role be one that I did not intend, that this was simply life. And, you know, you don't always get it the way you want it. And it's okay that you don't. Maybe it's a good thing that you don't always get it the way you want it. And that is another sort of message for me and that it's another burden for her and for a burden for my mother.
But I think from that passage, you see your mother and see yourself
yes.
in your
Yeah, I could see. I could finally see that, you know, that the connection in some sense had been unbroken there. I mean, that it had sort of been closed, that the circle was closed because, you know, these things of race are just pure nonsense. And, you know, there are survivals across generations of looks and quirks and yawning and snoring and little
and
things like that and food and, you know, whatever, you know, right. club toes and all that stuff is, you can't avoid it. You can't avoid your history.
Scott Minerbrook's memoir is Divided to the Vein. He's a national correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. Coming up, Maureen Carrigan reviews the new thriller by Scottish writer Margot Livesey. This is Fresh Air. Book critic Maureen Carrigan says that by the time you finish reading Criminals, Margot Livesey's dark morality play of a novel, you'll find yourself second and third guessing all your decisions.
Scottish writer Margot Livesey's new novel, Criminals, has the feel of one of those old-fashioned espionage thrillers written by her countryman, John Buchan. You know, the kind where a scatty Englishman picks up the wrong suitcase in a train station, and instead of socks and underwear, it contains the plans for the Fredonian overthrow of Great Britain. Well, here, our bumbling protagonist, Ewan Munro, isn't quite so innocent. When he sees a squirming bundle on the floor of the men's room in a bus station in Perth, Scotland, he doesn't mistake it for anything else but an abandoned baby. Ewan knows he should immediately report his discovery to the police, but his bus is leaving, and his troubled sister is anxiously waiting for him to arrive for a visit. And so Ewan just scoops up the infant and makes a dash for the door. For the rest of this disturbing novel, Ewan, like a typical Buchan hero, is trapped in a dizzying spiral of deceit. All the while he's pursued not by sinister foreign agents, but by the looming awareness that during those fateful seconds in the men's room, he became a stranger to himself. Ewan is not the only character in this novel who succumbs to what Poe called the imp of the perverse. Ewan's sister Molly has become emotionally unhinged after a breakup with her longtime lover, a novelist with whom she conducted a utopian experiment in living ecologically on a remote farm. When Ewan steps off the bus with a strange baby girl in his arms, Molly resolves to take her to the local authorities as soon as this patch of bad weather blows over. Ewan eventually leaves, and Molly draws the shutters and bolts the doors of her old farmhouse. We realize then that Molly's wistful fantasies have hardened into reality, and she and the baby are staying put. And then there's the baby's father, a seedy layabout named Kenneth. here's how Livesey delicately renders his half-conscious decision to abandon his illegitimate daughter, whose name is Grace. Kenneth eyed the long, low bus station and thought he could use the gents. Putting Grace down just inside the stall, he went over to the urinal and released a stream of urine. She was still being quiet, Christ Almighty, as he zipped up and edged away. The room was small, and two steps took him to the door. He opened it and stepped out. Maybe, he thought, she'd cry and bring him back. If she was really his daughter, she would claim him. Part of what makes Criminals such an ingenious, philosophically adroit novel is that Livesey captures the moral slipperiness of these moments of judgment. No one here is inherently good or bad. They all slide into sin, be it the despicable Kenneth or the seemingly more decent Ewan. It's as though the wet, twilight landscape that encloses these Scots has seeped into their souls so that they no longer see a bold black line demarcating right from wrong, only shades of gray. And after they've irrevocably crossed over into the realm of the wicked, our characters, even Ewan, who is a pedantic banker by trade, develop heretofore dormant talents for scheming and fast talking. Criminals would make the perfect sly gift for all those advice givers in your life who think they know how they would behave in every conceivable situation. Sure. As Margot Livesey subtly demonstrates, when people are distracted, distraught, or tempted by the main chance, there's no telling what they'll do.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Criminals by Margot Livesey. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Joan Tuohy, and Alan Tu, with Kathy Wolf and Tracy Tannenbaum. Dorothy Farabee is Fresh Air's administrative assistant. Audrey Bentham is our technical director. Our intern is Nate Hardy. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss Cohen.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.